don't want to offend.
What if they misunderstand?
I'm scared to say what I feel.
What's wrong with me?
They're gonna see what they want to see.
Everybody else seems fine.
Just say it.
This is Jen Slumack. You're listening to the podcast Just Say It, a show that aims to highlight the commonplaces among us. As we amplify a variety of voices, conversations, and questions, we hope and move together toward Dr. King's beloved community. Thank you for tuning in.
Troy.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
I'm so happy to have you with me. I've missed you, and if this is how we got a visit, I'm cool.
I know, huh? We ain't seen each other in a while, huh?
It's been a long while. Yeah, I mean, I've kept an eye on you, on what you're doing.
Likewise.
Look at you with your gray beard.
I know, ain't that right?
Who is this?
Who is this?
You look great, though, man. How are you feeling?
I feel good. I feel really good. I'm enjoying life. I'm in a good space in my life.
Amen.
In spite of what's going on, this is just more the same for me, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's it, right? And that's it.
Right.
Some people are seeing it for the first time and kind of blown away and not sure what to do about it all.
Right. Tell that to a black man in America. Right?
Yeah.
Like, okay. Interesting.
Yeah. You say what? You're
There's
kidding.
Racism in this country? What?
Right. What did, was it Will Smith?
You're a president that doesn't care?
Yeah, I think Will Smith said racism isn't getting worse, it's just getting filmed.
Right.
Right?
Exactly, right.
So, well, I just want to start by, I'm going to give a little background, and then what I'd really like to do is just tap into where your heart is at right now and what you're, you know, take the temperature on what's going on, because I want to introduce the audience to you. I want to introduce the audience to a story like yours, because my hope with this podcast is that it gets into the car or the earbuds of folks who otherwise wouldn't have the opportunity to meet someone like you, somebody who has spent the time that you've spent behind bars, a black man who has grown up the way that you've had to grow up and become a peacemaker and become somebody who just has done the inner work that I think is critical that the entire world starts to do, or we're not going to get anywhere. Because people don't get to hear the hearts that we get to hear when we do the work that we do.
Right.
Right. So I want to put just the human face on stuff.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, I could talk about you being a Game Changers Fellow. I could talk about you doing the TEDx talk in 2016 about how parolees are sentenced to fail. One of the comments that you said at one of our trainings that I did with you that you led, you said even, and I'm going to butcher it, to your face, which is bold.
the best kind of butchering is in my face. Right.
You said something along the lines of, even when I was in the height of my gang activity, my intent was to care for and protect my community.
Absolutely.
But now what has happened is that your community has grown.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's powerful.
Pretty on point. I'm surprised you remembered that. Wow.
That really hit me, man. Yeah, that really hit me.
Well, you know, and I think that's the thing that I go around and I try to do is I try to dispel a lot of the myths and rules that society tends to put on other people. And we say, well, those guys are bad. They'll do you like this, they'll do you like that, right? And I mean, it's what humans, I think, do in order to sort of gain an upper hand on other human beings, is we have to other somebody else and make them feel less than. And I just really, I think part of my talk there was to get people to see that I didn't really see myself as odd as some people may find this, but I didn't see myself any different than what an American soldier saw itself. You know, if you came and you bombed my Twin Towers, I was gonna bomb the shit out your Twin Towers. And guess what? You wasn't finna come back over here no more with that madness, right? And so I saw myself as a protector of my community. And, you know, like you just said, like I said back then, was that now the concept of who my community is has become so inclusive that I choose not to leave any human beings out of it. Right? That's in a nutshell is how I feel now and how I'm like trying to continue to live and move my life, you know?
Yes, sir. Yep. Yep. I was fortunate to meet Troy when you were still on the inside, San Quentin, and I came with Jack Dyson. Mm-hmm. You know him, right? Mm-hmm. I had just begun in the work of restorative justice. And I was so moved by him and the work that he was doing with restorative justice. And it seemed like he put vocabulary to what my heart had always felt was right, you know, but I didn't necessarily have the words to articulate. And I certainly didn't have the community who was interested in hearing it around me, right? So, that space lived in me, but it didn't have a community to flourish within, right? Mm-hmm. When I came and I saw you and several other men that I remember, I was just blown away by your capacity to stand in your truth and to be men who were vulnerable, but remarkably strong. And I have brothers. I grew up with brothers. And so I'd always wanted that for them and been grateful that nothing so horrific has ever made them have to face themselves in the ways that addiction has with me or incarceration has with some. But I'd always hoped that they could stand in their truth and have moved through their grief. And that's where I met Troy. Tell us who you are.
I was born in Chicago, raised in Southern California. Family migrated out here when I was young. So I was 3 years old. So don't ask me too much about Chicago because you might you might find that my baby's mind don't remember a lot. But we moved out here when I was pretty young. And, I guess the short part of the story is by the time I was 13 years old, gangs had just swept through my community like a wildfire, you know. And I felt sort of forced into like gang culture. Like I couldn't seek the protection of the police because we actually trusted them less than we did the gangs in our community. At least the gangs in our community was going to protect us. I got involved in that culture very young and then, started going to jail. By the time I was 27, I participated in a takeover robbery that resulted in people being moved around, which, you know, anytime a person is moved around during the commission of a robbery, it has the potential to turn it into aggravated kidnapping. And that's what happened in my case. A guy was forced outside of the location and into his car and ultimately carjacked for his car. So that turned the robbery into aggravated kidnapping. And ultimately, I was sentenced to life in prison. I went and sat for a while. And inside, I did like a lot of deep like reflection inside. Like, you know, like there's a lot of points that I realized how my community had failed me. When you look at the 7-year-old or the 13-year-old, even during school, like I learned the truth of my history from a black man on a prison tier. And when I say the truth of my history is that as a black man in America, a black person in America, my history didn't start with slavery, but that's all that schools tend to teach you. And when they speak of Africa or they speak of anything that has to do with my history is always spoken of as backwards and bush. And that has a deep psychological effect on our young people. And it starts from very young in schools. And so when I, you know, walked that tier and this man started to really educate me beyond slavery, it sparked something in me. You know, that and other things as well, but that was one of the moments that really sparked a sense of pride in who I was. I just started seeking knowledge, you know, like I started looking for knowledge. I studied 5 different things when I was inside. I studied my history. I studied the law. I studied religion. I studied media production, and I studied myself. And I don't mean that like in isolation, right? Like sometimes it gets on my nerves when people say, I did it all by myself. Nobody was there for me. And it's like, it's just not true. You know, it's impossible. So there was a lot of people that helped me along the way, you know, incarcerated people and, you know, people from the community. And in some sense, even, you know, on the rare occasion, there were guards and certain staff who like gave me good lessons in life. As a lifer, there are two types of life sentences in California. There's life without the possibility of parole, and there's life with the possibility of parole. So the particular crime that I was sentenced for gave me life with the possibility, and that means you have to go before what's called a board of prison hearings and they sort of assess whether or not they deem you a current threat to public safety. And if not, then they let you go. It sounds that simple, but for a lot of years, you know, we had governors who was like, I don't care what you in there for. I don't care how well you do. The only way you leave prison is in the body bag, right? And so for a lot of years, no matter how well you behaved, no matter what you did to transform your life, there was zero hope of coming home. You know, it wasn't until a lot of laws changed, a lot of people inside, you know, big shout out to all the jailhouse lawyers inside who fought cases back to back. You know, a lot of outside organizations and outside people who just are pushing this society for change, which made the board sort of have to give really more of a, I don't even know if this is the right word, but I'll just say more of a fair assessment of who a person was at the time of their hearing, and not just to hold me continuously liable for the crime I committed 20 plus years ago. You know, you have men that are being denied parole today that are actually dying in prison around this COVID situation that's happening for crimes that they committed 30 and 40 years ago when they were 17 and 20 years old, you know. I think that's part of what happens in our society is that we continue to paint the picture of the young, immature, you know, traumatized, impacted person who committed the crime when they went to prison. We continue to put that picture out there and don't put the picture of the old gray-bearded dude who's actually making some changes within himself and even within his community inside the prison.
Troy, I'm going to pause you right there because you've said so much, continuing to hold up the young traumatized man who's 17 years old, 18 years old. We criminalize adolescence, right? And we criminalize poverty. When you continue to look at that as the profile of somebody and forget about somebody matures away from that, typically, naturally, right? But also when having the opportunity to work on themselves, needs to be in the community as a mentor. I want to take a moment to reiterate and acknowledge the ramifications of criminalizing adolescence and criminalizing poverty in a tough-on-crime political atmosphere that creates sentencing structures that are just insane and pulls men out of their communities, which begets children raising children. That was another piece that struck me. And we actually know from study after study after study that children need some adults in their life. One caring and nurturing adult in their life can make the difference between somebody who is resourceful and resilient to somebody who is not capable of pulling themselves out of the most basic situations in life. And here's the thing. With the community being eaten away at the way that it is, those who are left behind are so destabilized that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So as I sit here and talk with you, Troy, having gone through all that you've gone through and having come out the way that you have, I suspect that there was one, if not more than one, adult in your life that you knew cared about you. Is that true?
My father passed away last year, and you know, I was angry with my father for a lot of years, but when I really look back on life, like, my father tried to give me some really great tools. You know, like, him and my mother were married 57 years, you know, but I think what happened was that the voices in society drowned out the voice in my home.
I just think that's what happens in adolescence.
Exactly, right? Exactly, right? And so a lot of those voices got drowned out. But then when I you know, was sentenced to life and I'm on this prison tier, I knew that I couldn't continue my gang involvement in that environment, right? I'm already, you know, sentenced to life in prison. I'm worried about, you know, my children. I didn't want to continue that pattern. And so I wanted to figure out me. And my way of doing that was to try to, in my mind, was to just dig back through history to understand history. And I heard people, I was fortunate to go to Lancaster at that time. And, you know, I guess the fortunate, unfortunate part, right, that, like, the yard that they put me on, the black men on that yard treated it like it was Timbuktu. Like we had scholars on that yard. Like, there were scholars. Like, when you walked in the room to where they would be discussing or debating history, you couldn't talk unless you knew the facts, right? And the moment somebody started to say, "Well, I feel," I remember I did that. I was like, "Well, I feel." They was like, stop right there. Time out. You need to go do your homework. Go do your research. That's not about feelings. Don't come in this room. Feelings. History has no place for feelings. And you know, so if you want to walk in this room and you want to have a scholarly discussion, check your feelings and let's bring your facts. Bring your dialelia. They used to say that. Bring your facts to the table.
That sets the bar.
That set a very high bar, you know. And so I'm like, wow, these dudes are brilliant, right? And they would go back and forth from, you know, throughout history, and just to, you know, really have some real scholarly, like, and I don't even want to call it debates, but just some scholarly conversations about history. And that, like, to see that from so many men in my environment, like wow, like I missed that part. You know, I missed that part. This is what I should have got in school.
Yeah.
You know, this the part I should have got in school, because, you know, remember, we're forced to sit in the classroom where the teacher says the founding forefathers, you know, principles of justice and equality for all, right? And I would raise my hand, I'd be like, but not for my people. And then they'd be like, you're a troublemaker, you know, like.
You're not the first person that I've had on my show that has said that without me prompting it. So I just want to raise that up, because that happens all the time. And talked about the harm that causes. And also the system that educates the teachers is very limited. And then the teacher is not equipped to deal with somebody asking questions that are relevant and outside of their knowledge. They don't know what to do with them. And so then they, like, deem you a troublemaker. I'd love to see some of these men who looked like you being in your community to inspire you and incite the desire to learn and to grow the way that these scholars on the yard did. I want to see those voices from the prison yard returned to the community. And I know that that's been important to you, too.
Once I got to San Quentin and started working in the, you know, the video department, like, that was my whole mission, was to get our voices out.
That's right.
You know, to get our voices outside of that prison, you know, which actually is probably as good a time as any to mention. If you look over my shoulder right here, you see that big poster of the prison within.
I want to talk to you about that too.
That's coming out, and started, you know, helping with that film when I was inside.
Really?
And then came home, and yeah, that was one of the films that I helped, you know, do video production work and did some audio work and stuff on it when I was inside. And then I came home and became a subject in the film. And it's doing very, very well.
It comes out tomorrow, right? August 25th?
Tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
Saturday, right?
I got him here, folks.
Right. Yeah, it's coming out tomorrow on Amazon. And so, yeah, I'm real proud of it, too.
Tell us about it, Troy.
Yeah. Well, you know, it just, like, every time a volunteer came in, like, our connection, you know, this work in restorative justice sort of gave you language for what you, like, intuitively knew. Like, I think that's the point where we really, like, clicked at, because that's my truth as well, right? Uh-huh. And it's like, how could this thing called restorative justice or this work, like, is so profound that it actually gives language to people from all different types and walks of life?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I'm sort of making that sort of comparison, like, to the film, because a lot of times we go in and we just look at the prisoners and we say, well, you know, you need to grow and, you know, understand what, you know, brought you to do this or do that. And then we don't ask the same of society.
That's right.
Right. Film is sort of trying to get society to take a look at what box society has put what box we've put ourselves in that is ultimately leading us to a prison, whether it is a physical prison or an emotional or spiritual prison. You know, I think that's the sort of ultimate, like, question that is asked with this film.
And thank God for that. Mm-hmm. I worked in the county jail for many years.
I remember, and
I was an instructor / facilitator. I remember one of my students, you know, he had been in my class about 6 months, and we were doing the work that we did. Fridays, we had restorative circle. Every Friday, they counted on it, you know. They had to be there every day of the week in order to be in circle, so my attendance just shot up because they wanted to be in that space, right? Mm-hmm. And we dealt with the things that we dealt with, and one of my guys was there for like 5 months, 6 months, and he was just really getting it, man. He was really, the lights had come on, and he was just like, I didn't even know this existed. And then he got out, and then he came back. And he came back holding his head down and, you know, walked into my class and, Miss Jen, you know, I'm sorry I'm back and I didn't mean to disappoint you. I said, none of this is about me, man. I said, let's talk about what happened, right? What happened? And he said, for real? He said, I started getting better and then I had to go home. And Miss Jen, out in the world, there ain't room for nobody but the man who left, because they've been waiting on him to come back. There's just no places like your class out there. And that's when I decided I got to be doing the work I was doing in there, out here. Mm-hmm. So tell us, what is The Prison Within?
So it's a documentary that started with the backdrop of a Vogue class.
Vogue is Victim Offender Education Group.
Victim Offenders Education Group, right? It started off with that class where, you know, typically there are several different prisoners who go through the group, and they sort of explore trauma throughout their life and sort of what brought them to commit the harms, the crimes that they did against other people, which ultimately brought them to prison, right? So it starts off with that sort of as a backdrop, but then it moves beyond just the prisoners looking at what brought them to do their harm, right? Like, there's a facilitator, Jamie. I don't know if you ever remember Jamie Carroll, but
Jamie, she's not with us anymore, right?
She's not with us, exactly, right?
Yeah.
So Jamie, Jamie passed away, but Jamie explores, you know, a lot of, like she said, you know, I realized that, you know, but for certain things in my life, I could be sitting like right here, because right, I've done some things, I've thought some things, I've been through some stuff, right? And then it also moves forward to another lady named Dion, and Dion's husband was a police or a sheriff. I don't remember which one, but he was law enforcement, and he was murdered in the traffic stop. And she fought and fought and fought to get the guy who murdered her husband onto death row, because that's what she was told that would bring her closure. That's what she was told that would, like, you know, be healing. And she did it. She fought. And she got the guy to death row, and they succeeded, and the closure never came.
Hmm.
That moment never came.
That's right.
And she still found herself in a world of resentment and anger, you know, and just like, and so that's what actually brought her to come inside the prison. And there's sort of this dynamic where, like, us inside, we get a lot from the people that come inside, but then also the people who comes inside get a lot from us.
That's right.
And so the film, right, really explores the dynamic of exchange, as opposed to typically how people, like, you know, Jesus came in and he saved the poor people, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
From, you know what I mean? Like this typical savior like concept that comes in when, yeah. And the truth is, if we're gonna save society, all the stakeholders have to be at the table.
We all got to get in the boat, man.
We got to get in the boat, right? Right.
So Dion realized what? Realized that wasn't the solution.
That wasn't the solution. And if you want to know more, you have to watch the film.
Okay. I was going to see if maybe you'd be willing to do a screening with me and we could host a virtual screening.
Yeah. I think they definitely want there to be a lot of screens. I'm 100% on board.
Sure. Yeah, but it's sure. It's not entirely your project. So you got to ask,
right.
See what you can do with that. Talk to me about COVID in San Quentin.
Whew, Lord, that brings up a lot.
Are you able to talk about that right now? Or I mean, your heart.
Absolutely. No, okay. I think what I try to do is that when you first ask the question, a little bit of anger comes up with me,
yeah.
And I want to lash out, right? And what I've, like, learned over the years, that not always, like, lashing out is the best method to actually bring about healing, right? And so I'm angry at the fact that you have a system that cares so less or thinks so little that they would actually put so many people in harm's way, you know, and not just the prisoners inside, but the prison guards as well. You know, I mean, like, a guard has lost their life in addition to, you know, I think there's about 19 or 20, you know, last I counted, there were 19, you know, prisoners who lost their lives due to COVID, and all behind a transfer that did not have to happen. Like, you know, I don't know if your audience is familiar with what happened, but San Quentin had zero cases of COVID, and another prison, I believe it was Chino, had a bunch of cases, and what they decided to do was transfer 121 prisoners from Chino over to San Quentin. Why? Who knows? They transferred these people in, and all of a sudden, San Quentin cases of COVID just start to blow through the roof. One of the reasons why is because there is no such thing as social distance inside of San Quentin. Right? You can't stay 6 feet apart when the cells are 4 feet apart and somebody's sleeping on a bunk above you. Right? So there's, and they're not doors. These are bars. Like, these are bars. I want your audience to think about an apartment complex that has maybe 300, I want to say 320 apartments, little micro 4 foot by 10 foot deep apartments in it. And then there's a box sitting up over the apartment complex. There's no ventilation in that building. There's no opportunity for social distance. And then the administration also was not allowing hand sanitizer. You know, they gave out masks like once or a couple of times, right? Like, it just became like a nightmare. So my initial like thought is just like, somebody's head needs to roll, you know? Like,
yeah,
like this should not be happening. Like, I worried. I got a phone call from a friend, one of my friends in there, who was like, man, he said, I've been locked up since 1984. I've been through 11 different prisons, and I've never seen anything like this. And that says a lot. That says a lot. So I'm worried about, you know, the people inside, and I'm also feeling like helpless, because what can we really do, you know, to protect them?
And I think that that is a big question that exists around a lot of the things that we work for, the kind of understanding and protection and, you know, engagement that we hope for through the work that, you know, that you're doing, is that we want people to be aware. Your description, thank you for describing the environment in a way that folks who haven't experienced it could maybe understand a little bit. That's horrifying. It's horrifying, right? And we're talking about people, you know, I started to think about a month into this shelter in place that as people started to get a little squirrely and started to, you know, call me, I'd be like, I don't know what to do with myself. I'm getting depressed. I don't know. I say, you got a TV, you got Zoom, you got grocery stores, you got a car, you got, I try to appreciate, but I've spent so much time inside that that's where my head and heart went right away. I'm like, can we maybe take this COVID and turn it into an education for the general public of what isolation can do to a human being, what it does to relationship, what lack of human contact can do to the psychology of a person, of a family, of a community? Can we use this somehow to educate, to really like be like, oh yeah, that feeling, that isolation, that depression? Immediately I hear, yeah, but they committed a crime. Yeah, but they did that. Yeah, but they're bad, but they deserve, but they should be. And I hear all of that mess. And I just want to be like, just stop.
Right,
because we don't value human life enough, because we've made commodity out of bodies.
That's the real reason. Like, you know, that's the real thing. Like, you know, just to get real, you know, people will say, well, they committed a crime. No, you mean they got caught for a crime, right? Because there's a whole lot of people out here that committed crimes, and they're not even, they don't even have to worry about seeing the inside of a prison.
You gonna vote? Oh, I don't want to go there, but
right.
Can you vote?
Yeah, absolutely, and I will be.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For the first time in almost 25, 30 years.
So here's a question. What are your thoughts about the way that our country has been going and the impact of the votes not able to be cast because of felony and because of incarceration? It's bigger than that, huh?
I mean, it is. I mean, it's just another thing to divide and conquer, right? It's just another thing. It's a, I mean, you know, it all just points back to the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. It points back to Dred Scott. It just points back to the fact of how we just continue to allow what comes off as sick.
Say that again.
We continue to allow what comes off or presents as logic.
Yeah, yeah.
To be excuses for us to dehumanize each other.
That's right. That's right.
And I mean, that's just, for me, that's it. Like, in a nutshell. You know, like, I mean, there's I think there's only like two states where you still can vote, even if you're incarcerated. In California, you have to be off parole, off paperwork. Then you can
register.
Vote. But there are a number of states that no matter what, once you've committed a felony, you can never like vote again. I wish they would say that about taxes.
Ha. Okay. Man.
You committed a felony. You can never pay taxes again.
Yeah, see?
You're disenfranchised, buddy.
Yeah. You welcome that one, huh?
Right.
Are you still facilitating? Tell us about what you do these days.
Well, you know, I think back to like the conversation you had earlier. I think we click on so many different points, but it's like, I still go inside mostly juvenile facilities, working with, well, I haven't been able to be in this COVID stuff. It's kind of, you know, stopped all that process, but I'm still working with young people, inside. And my goal has been to, take that work, to the prevention intervention level, right? To work with youth, to stop that movement, you know, that prison, that school to prison pipeline, to sort of stop that whole trajectory. And I got some funding, small little piece of funding to run a 10-week program in the community where I grew up. And so I've been traveling back down to L.A., to Lynnwood, to initiate this program in my community. And the whole goal is to work with young people, you know, in the area where I grew up so that they don't feel they have to turn to that and they get to process some of the emotions and some of the things that they're going through. Because basically, if we're going to shut the prison system down, we got to stop the flow of bodies headed that way. And that comes, you know, in the form of policy. It comes in the form of, you know, decriminalizing a lot of different like things that probably shouldn't be crimes in the first place. You know,
such as
I got marijuana's legal now, and I still, you know people in jail because they were serving marijuana. you know, I just want to. My battle is on the side of the young people, you know, to make sure they got better opportunities and that they understand, at least have somebody a sounding board for them, so that as they're going through, you know, this life, that they're not left with the confusion, and they don't have to wait for a black man on the prison tier, this black man coming back to his community.
Well, and that's what I was going to say, too, is a man like you comes back looking like you look, like you've been where you've been and know what you know. I mean, you can see it in your eyes, right? You wear it and you see them. You're able to look at them and see them and hear them and know them. And that can change everything, man. They say it takes one person, one adult, one adult who affirms and confirms you can make the difference in a young person's life. You know, I had a teacher. You know, and you can go back and be that man to some of those youngsters. Mm-hmm. Question for you. Do you ever feel resentful the amount of things that you got to do that are great for people to be like, okay, he's out but he's doing good. Like, you ever wish you could have just got out and just like not done anything, just be free, just be like, you know what? I'm not giving back. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing that. I'm not changing policy. I'm tired. I just want to lay on the couch and watch Netflix. Leave me alone.
You know, I had to make a decision, and I don't do this for those people. I don't care what people say. They're going to talk about me anyway, right? I could be doing all the best stuff in the world, and somebody still going to find a reason to talk about me. So I am really, as nicely as I can say this, I don't care what people got to say about me. Yeah, exactly. You know, take two of these and call me in the morning. Right?
But you know what, though, man? That's one of them locks from the prison within. That's one of those things that you have to come to through a lot of reflection, right? Recognizing how much power we give to what others think of us.
Exactly.
I'm still trying to untangle that myself, but I've come a long way.
Right. Exactly. You know? I do this, you know, and this is, I learned to be a little bit selfish, you know, in this sense, you know. One is that I do what I do because I have to do it, right? This is for our young people, and it's also for myself.
Yes, sir.
You know, I can't go back and unwind the clock for me, but I can damn sure go remove some roadblocks for somebody else, because it's like I'm going back in time, and I know where the roadblocks are, so I can cover the ditch that this youngster fixing to fall into. You know what I'm saying? I can build a ladder so this youngster can reach the next platform that he can get to that I couldn't reach, because I didn't have the tools to climb that mountain. You know, so you know, I have to give back, you know, and I want to just continue to build. You know, I'm traveling, I'm doing a lot of stuff. Well, COVID is messing up my travel schedule. But
you and me, you both, know, man.
I'm also, you know, I'm also, like, last year I was in Africa. You know, I went to Uganda and I went to South Africa. And, you know, the truth is that thought came up to me. Like, I don't even want to go back to America. Like, I don't even want to go back.
Yep.
And then the obligation that I felt in my heart, you know, to do some work over here, to continue some of the work that I've been doing over here is really what brought me back.
Yeah.
Because other than that, I probably wouldn't have came back.
Yeah. Well, it's not the same at all, but I can, you know, that resonates with me as somebody who's given up substances, just because it's my heart's work to, I like how you said about, you know, I can cover that ditch that I see that, you know, person walking towards and stuff like that. Cause that's how I am with the drugs and the alcohol is it's my life's work to work with other people who are, you know, in addiction, because addiction, you know, it's one of those things that sort of comes out of trauma. You know, it's one of the things that we reach for to medicate the pain that has become more than we can handle.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Right. And that's the understanding we had, like I was always afraid of hard drugs because, to be truthful, I just was stupid enough without them.
That's so, how I felt. I wouldn't do them because my imagination does not need an imagination.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So, but I was angry. Like, I was an angry individual. Like, yeah. You know, I was 230 pounds of muscle aggression, you know, and like that was my escape, though, you know. Yeah. like
anger, like, was your drug.
Anger was my drug.
Yeah.
Anger was, and I was a pothead back in the day too, but that was my, I just learned that all of these things, we do these things because we're trying to escape a feeling that we have. And so what I learned through meditation also is just sit with it. Like, let your body feel it. And all the answers that you need, your body gonna give to you. The spirit gonna give to you.
Yeah.
Right.
Did you do Verdun's Sitting in the Fire?
I, you know, it wasn't, many programs that I didn't do.
Yeah, okay.
I think there were like, at one time there was like 88 programs there in San Quentin, and I probably went through 50 of them and created 12, you know,
yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah. Yeah, Jacques did something called Sitting in the Fire where.
Yeah, that was his. Jacques went through a few different programs, but what he ultimately, I think, became his biggest success program is the Grip.
Guiding Rage into Power.
Yeah, Guiding Rage into Power. But Sitting in the Fire is a term I still use to this day when I talk to people.
The emotional fire, huh?
Yeah, you got to sit. You got to sit it. You got to sit with it. You can't run from it. You know, one thing that is tough as I want to be, one thing that I realized was it's not within my capability, and that is to ignore my emotional makeup, because they will find a way to the surface.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. If I don't channel them, they will leak.
They will. Yes, they sir. Absolutely will. Yeah. So you better deal with them yourself, because they're going to deal with you if not.
Huh.
Right?
Yeah. I'd love to do a talk with you sometime just to sort of share the journey of Vogue that one goes through. Just kind of share that with folks as sort of an outline. Because it's unbelievable work, man. It's just remarkable work. And there's such capable and just passionate facilitators that come in and just provide the space. I remember sitting in a circle that had probably 50 men in it, man. And we were sitting there and just, you know, it's this place where folks start to, as you said, sort of uncover the traumas that sort of manifested in their life and that they didn't really know. Cause I mean, when you come up in an environment, and the environment could be your home, could be your neighborhood, could be both, right? That just doesn't provide what a young person needs, right? And makes a young person responsible for things that is not their responsibility, you know? Yeah. And that distorts the whole development process, man. That just tangles it all up. Yeah. And so, as you said, you know, anger was your drug. Like, we find the things that allow us to feel powerful in what seems to be a powerless situation. And then you find, you know, these men, and I'm talking to my audience right now, you find men that we have vilified, you know, it becomes so clear that they are, you know, our daddies and our brothers and our uncles and our sons right before your eyes as they start to see themselves for the first time. Because a lot of folks haven't had the opportunity to sit with themselves in a place that was safe and ask questions and wonder and say out loud some of the things that they've seen and say out loud some of the things that they've witnessed or been forced to participate in or experienced or had done to them. And so you start to see that happen, and you start to see people see themselves for the first time, and what follows then is the accountability for what I've done, the harm that I've caused my community, the homicide or the rape or the robbery or the kidnapping or whatever. We start to take accountability for the things that we've done, the way that our trauma has manifested into behavior.
You know what I tell people? That every time somebody tried to get hard with me about things I had done, and they tried to come off hard and abrasive, I can meet anger with aggression. I can meet aggression with aggression, right? I don't care if you're talking about you want to battle with guns, knives, sticks, or billy clubs, right? I know how to deal with that part.
That's the nature of survival, is to one-up you.
Exactly, right? And so... But when somebody met me with empathy, like that, now I got to one-up that.
Yeah.
You know, like that, that's a different level. Like that is a different level of connectivity.
Yeah.
Right? When somebody, because somebody saw beyond the external hardened features, right? And they saw the little boy who just went through the pain and really just wanted somebody to love him.
That's right.
Really, that's it. We all just want to be loved. Right? And we put up these walls. We go to the prison within. You know, we put up these walls. And these walls cut us off from humanity.
I had a student come up to me one time after class. He got in trouble from the deputy because he lagged behind, but he came up to my desk. He said, "Miss Jen, why do you put up with me?" And I said, "What?" He goes, "I always got questions. I always got something to say. Why do you put up with me?" And I said, "Because you're somebody's baby." Mm-hmm. Yep. And if we can see each other that way, what a gift. I count myself very blessed to have that vision, to be able to see that. And I wish that more of the world could, but it's, you got to do your own work to get out of your own way. You know what I mean?
That's a good old Southern statement right there. I ain't heard that in a long time.
Which one?
When you say, "Cause you're somebody's baby."
Yeah. Somebody's baby. Yeah. So the process then goes on to the healing of, like, how do I take accountability for what I've done, but also how do I honor the victims of the crime and or the harm, we like to say the harm done, because it's about relationships and harming relationships. Yeah. It's not about crime against the state.
Yeah.
And that's an important distinction. And we go on to have surrogates a lot of times in the circle. We're about out of time, but are you willing to share a surrogate experience, what that was like, or what that is in terms of the circle?
Did you say the surrogate experience?
Yeah, yeah.
So, well, you know, in the process of, you know, Vogue, one of the things that we did was they would bring in what was considered to be what they called a surrogate victim. In other words, somebody who, because the system does not allow you to actually sit across from the actual person that you harmed, you have to bring in somebody who has suffered a similar harm from the similar offense in which you committed, and you sit across from them. And, you know, my story in that regard is that, you know, at that time in my life, I couldn't imagine what the victims in my case went through, right? Like, yeah, I could think, oh, they were scared. They like fear for their life, right? Or whatever, but shit, I've been dealing with that all my life. So I'm like,
I don't have a soft spot for that.
No, it's like, it's what, that's what it is. That's life.
Welcome right? to it. Yeah.
Right. And so, but what I realized from sitting across from this woman who was on my surrogate panel, I saw how fear had caused her to sort of shrink and sort of cowered in and cut herself off from society, right? Like, she cut herself off literally where she was afraid to go outside. Like, she was afraid to walk down the street. And I saw how it, like, you know, it cut her off where she became afraid of people, and her fear caused her to look sort of cowered in, right? And it made me reflect on how my fear made me afraid of people, but I cowered out. You know, I became aggressive. And if I thought you was going to do something to me, I'm going to get you first. You know, so it really gave me a peek into my own spirit, like my own deepest trauma. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but feel for her and feel for the little boy within me who basically took that same approach, but just became more aggressive as a defense mechanism. Yeah, so I think, and I want to say this too, I think for a lot of victims, or we like to call them survivors,
yeah.
But I know victim is a more common term that people understand. But what we learn from when they come in is that like they really want to know answers to questions that only somebody who committed the crime can answer.
Such right? as?
And I've also noticed from working with a lot of different victims that, you know, after the moment passes where, you know, sort of the rage and the revenge sort of level, you know, this really seeking justice in a harmful way sort of passes, most people really want to know that the person is taking accountability for what they've done and that they're doing something of benefit to other human beings. When those two things sort of meet up, I think, at least my experience of dealing with many victims, they feel, I mean, there's a connection, there's a different bridge that happens for that. So, just the power of a surrogate panel is very empowering. And I also want to let people know, like, don't go just try to do this. Like, these things are facilitated by trained people, both volunteers on the outside and the inside, and they know what they're doing. And it takes some prep. It takes time to get to that moment where you can bring people together in a safe, you know, environment, in a safe, you know, sacred place. So it's not like you just go and get, you know, hey, you did this, come on, let's talk. You know,
yeah, it doesn't. Don't do that.
Don't do that. Don't do that. that might turn out very different.
Yeah, yeah. That's not what we're talking about here.
That's not what we're talking about.
Listen, Troy, man, I could talk to you for 3 more hours at least, but I want to respect your time because I know you're doing a lot, and I want to thank you for being here with me today, and know that I would love to do this again. I think we could do a whole nother episode with Absolutely. Very little effort and a Absolutely. Lot of richness.
Absolutely. So, I must have been excited about it. I've been up since 3 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, you couldn't wait to see me.
It's Christmas.
I love you, man. I do. Love I got you too. I got a lot of love for you, and I appreciate you so much. Thank you for sharing yourself Absolutely. With us this
Likewise.
Morning.
Likewise.
All right, man.
All right, sis. Take care. Talk later.
Yes, sir. Bye-bye.
This has been another episode of Just Say It. I am your host, Jen Slumak, and I want to thank you for coming by. I encourage you to go to my website, www.soulnotskin.com. Tell your friends if you enjoyed the episode, and we'll see you next time.